It's 9:06. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network. Kathleen will be back next Tuesday. Ah, the 70s. Disco, leisure suits, platform shoes, and stagflation. One of those unpleasant memories is coming back to life, and it hasn't improved with age. My guest this hour is Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and he's not joining me to talk about disco or leisure suits. The topic this hour is stagflation. You can weigh in with your comments at 800-486-8655 and 227-2050. Here's the email address, talk@wpr.org. Good morning, Mr. Baker, and welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's start out by asking the most obvious question. What is stagflation?
Well, stagflation was a term we came up with in the 70s because, coming out of the 60s, of course, being kind of the golden age of the economy, you know, we had very strong economic growth, very low unemployment. The unemployment rate was down to 3%. Wages were growing rapidly. Really kind of the best of times. And, you know, all the economists were very happy to take credit for it because, you know, in a lot of ways it seemed like we had the big problems licked. We sort of had this idea that we could choose a rate of inflation, choose a rate of unemployment. And the idea was there was some trade-off so that, you know, if we thought the unemployment, the inflation rate was too high, then the way to solve that was slow the economy a little bit, have somewhat higher unemployment, and vice versa. If we were worried the unemployment rate was too high, you know, we lowered the unemployment rate, we might have a bit more inflation. But the idea was, you know, those were sort of trade-offs. The world sort of fell apart in the 70s because we suddenly had the situation where we had rising inflation and higher unemployment, and, you know, that left, you know, a lot of economists surprised, and they're sort of sitting around trying to figure out what was going on. And that's where the term stagflation came from, that we both had slow growth, higher unemployment, at the same time that inflation was high and rising. So it's the mix of both, you know, the bad news on both sides, inflation and unemployment and slow growth.
Well, let's look at the 60s a little bit, and you were talking about we thought we could pick a number for inflation. How would we be able to do that? What was the thinking at that time about how the economy could be controlled? Was it strictly monetary policy, or was there something else going on there?
Well, it was really both monetary and fiscal policy. So the idea was both, you know, if the economy was weak, you can give it a boost either by lowering interest rates. So you have the Federal Reserve Board lowering interest rates. That, of course, gives it a boost. It's easier for people to borrow money to buy a car or buy a house, whatever it might be. So that will give the economy a boost. Alternatively, we also, and of course the famous example was the Kennedy tax cuts in 63, that we boosted the economy by cutting taxes. And the intention, at least the economists who designed it at the time, was that was putting money in people's pockets. So it wasn't supply side, it was thought to be demand side, that they would put more money in people's pockets, they would spend it, and that would boost the economy. So it was both by, you know, through Federal Reserve Board policy, lowering interest rates, but also simply government spending money that could boost the economy.
Well, I mean, I had thought that stagflation was just a relic of the Nixon administration. Why has it come back now? Or why do you think it's come back now?
Yeah, no, I think it has come back. Maybe I'm more pessimistic than most on this, but I think it has come back. It's taking a very different form. I mean, what happened in the 70s, well, I shouldn't say totally different form. We had a big oil price increase with the forming of OPEC in 73, 74, and then the late 70s, the Iranian Revolution took about 6 million barrels a day of production, which at that time was about twice as much as it would be today relative to the world market. So we had big rises in oil prices. There was a big rise in wheat prices associated with big purchases from the Soviet Union back then. So a big rise in commodity prices. That was very front and center in the story. We're looking at a different picture today, though. We do have that. We do obviously have a rise in oil prices, not as big relative to what we saw back in the 70s. So although we're, you know, all upset about paying $3 a gallon for gas and, you know, higher prices for home heating oil, the increase is not nearly as large as what we saw back in the 70s, at least not proportionately. So we are seeing higher oil prices, but we're also seeing higher import prices. And the story there is simply we had an overvalued dollar. This was, you know, sort of the flip side of the good news in the 90s. In the 90s, the dollar rose significantly against the euro, the European currency, against the Canadian currency, and particularly against the currencies in East Asia. Now we're seeing the reverse of that. That couldn't be sustained. We got good news in the 90s in that respect, in the sense that we could buy those goods from those countries. Imports from those countries were very cheap if our dollar's high. That means we can get a lot of goods from Canada or a lot of goods from Europe or China very cheaply. When the dollar starts to fall, all those goods become more expensive to us. So that's the inflation side of the stagflation. The stag side, why is the economy stagnating? Well, that was our housing bubble. We had our economy sustained through most of this decade by this unprecedented run-up in house prices. So we saw the housing sector boom. Sales of homes were hitting new records every month. You know, back in 04, 05, house prices went up as they never had before in our entire history. And that was great while it was going on, except, you know, it was inevitable that would not persist. And, you know, just as the tech bubble back in the stock market in the 90s couldn't continue, exact same story with the housing market. We saw construction go to record levels. We had overbuilding. And now we have an incredible glut. And, of course, everything's going the other way. House prices are falling. And that's what's giving us the stagnation because, first and foremost, obviously the housing sector's collapsed. The housing start numbers that came out yesterday were at about half the level where we were back in 05. But more importantly, houses are people's major asset, you know, for the vast majority of people. Most of their wealth is in their home. And when house prices start falling, as they are now, and in fact falling quite rapidly, that is destroying a lot of wealth, which means both people have to cut back consumption because they can't borrow against their homes as they had been doing. But secondly, you have a lot of people that, you know, they're getting near retirement. They're in their 50s, even their 60s. And they thought they had a home that was worth, you know, $400,000, and now they're finding the home's worth $300,000. They don't have nearly as much money going into retirement as they expected. So we're seeing people cut back consumption in a very big way, which is pushing the economy into a recession. So we get the stagflation from rising oil prices falling, the inflation part from the rising oil prices falling dollar, and we're getting the stagnation part from the collapse of the housing bubble.
Well, let's talk about that housing bubble just a little bit, and then I want to go back to something else that you mentioned earlier about the dollar. But one of the things that's happened, that's been happening over the last, I don't know, maybe decade, people have practically been living off the equity in their homes. I mean, you have all these home equity mortgage accounts or these almost like it's, okay, you can take the value in your home and spend it like you would out of your checkbook. And so people were buying cars on this margin. They were doing all sorts of things with the equity in their home. All of a sudden, they find out instead of having equity in their home, they're actually upside down with their mortgage. Their mortgage the value of their mortgage is higher than the value of the real estate that's pledged against it. And this, of course, has caused a lot of other problems. But if we can take a look at this, the last decade, haven't we basically been living off credit, period? I mean, credit card debt is at an all-time high. We basically we borrowed our way to what looked, at least on the surface, to a healthy economy.
That's exactly right. You know, we're borrowing like crazy. The borrowing against the home is more important than the borrowing against credit card debt, but against credit cards. But that has gone up as well. But you know, just to give you orders of magnitude, we have around $10 trillion in mortgage debt, whereas credit card debt is just now, I don't think we crossed the trillion yet. We're getting close to it. But you know, basically, we're about 10 times as much mortgage debt as credit card debt. But people obviously were using both, and you know, what was going on there, house prices were running up. We'd never seen this before, and I this is not hindsight. I emphasize this because, you know, there are a lot of other economists who should have been saying this. I was saying this. There were other economists, but unfortunately most economists, particularly the ones like Alan Greenspan or controlling policy, were saying the opposite. But it was clear house prices could not keep continuing going up at the same rate, and in fact we're not even likely to keep that, you know, the prices that they hit, because we just, there was nothing to support it. You know, when you go back and, you know, there's a very good economist at Yale, Robert Shiller, who went back to 1895, and he found over the whole century, from 1895 to 1995, house prices had just risen at the same rate as the price of other goods. So if you look at the overall rate of inflation, the price of food, of clothes, of cars, you know, you average that everything in, house prices had risen at just the same rate as the price of other goods over that whole century. Suddenly, in the decade from 1995 to 2005, house prices had risen by 70% above the rate of inflation.
Why was that?
Well, you know, basically you had a bubble dynamic get going. It was a similar story to what you had in Japan in the 80s, where you had a house bubble and stock bubble growing up side by side. So beginning of the run-up in house prices was in the mid-90s. A lot of it centered in some of the tech centers like Silicon Valley, Boston, you know, areas where people have made a lot of money in the stock market. And there's a kind of a simple story you could tell that, you know, you have someone who's made a lot of money in the stock market, well, they decided they want a bigger house. And at least in the short term, you know, the supply of housing is relatively fixed. So if you have a lot of people made money in the market and they're looking for bigger houses, in the short term, at least, that pushes up house prices. Now, over long term, of course, you could build more homes. But the key here is that got this dynamic going where people started to see house prices rising. Now, that continued through the 90s as we, you know, had the stock market bubble keep going and going. The big difference between the United States and Japan was that in Japan, the two bubbles collapsed together. They had a real estate and stock bubble. They both collapsed in 1990. In the United States, when the stock bubble collapsed, a lot of people said, well, at least housing is safe. So you had a lot of people who actually took money out of the stock market in 01, 02, you know, after taking very big losses. They decided housing was very safe. At the same time, the Federal Reserve Board pushed interest rates to a 50-year low, so we had mortgage rates get as low as 5.35%, the lowest we'd seen since the mid-50s. And that, you know, certainly helped fuel the housing bubble. So while Japan, the two collapsed together, the collapse of our stock bubble actually, ironically, helped feed the housing bubble. And, you know, as I say, it develops its own dynamic, because what happens is, if you've seen prices in your area go up 15 or 20%, you look at a home very differently than, you know, if they've basically been flat. So you see a home that might sell for $400,000, and, you know, maybe 5 years ago you look at that and you go, well, that home's not worth $400,000. But on the other hand, if you look at it and you go, well, you know, it's probably going to sell for $500,000 in 3 years, well, then maybe it is worth $400,000. So people came to expect that prices would continue to rise. And that's what sustained the bubble and allowed prices to continue to rise for as long as they did. But, you know, again, at the end of the day, we could always build more housing. It takes time, but you build more housing. But what eventually caught up with the bubble was we had more houses there than people were prepared to buy, and that caused prices to stop rising. And, of course, as we know now, they're falling.
We're talking with Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and the topic under discussion is, the bigger topic is the economy. We're talking about stagflation, which is an economic condition. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number. Or you can call, if you're in Milwaukee, you can call our local number, which is 227-2050. You can also send us an email. Here's the address, talk@wpr.org. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk to some people on the phone who want to ask a question of Mr. Baker, and I have a few more questions of my own. This economic stuff is complicated. I got a B in economics in college, and I want to tell you it was the hardest course I ever took. So if we'll try and I want to make sure we really explain everything as we go along here, and we may not get to everything before the end of the hour, but hopefully we'll all get a clearer picture of where we are economically. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 21 minutes after 9 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week. Kathleen will be back next Tuesday. Well, here's what's coming up later on the Ideas Network. In spite of Latin America's struggle to create fairer communities, making it one of the most prosperous laboratories for democracy, it remains on the fringe of the world stage. After 3 on Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders with Gene Faraca, find out why Latin America is often a forgotten continent. That's coming up later on the Ideas Network. It's the economy this hour. Specifically, an economic condition called stagflation. We're talking about it with Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research in Washington, D.C. And he's joining us by phone, and you can too, at 800-486-8655 or 227-2050. Earlier in the conversation, and I wanted to come back to this before we move any further, you were talking about in the 90s, the dollar was overvalued. It has since dropped in value. Explain to me how currencies change in value toward one another. What are the things that that affect that, and why was the dollar overvalued in the 90s? What caused that? And then What caused the reverse to happen in this decade?
Well, the immediate determinant of currency prices is simply the market. So we have investors that are trading in the currencies, you know, the dollar, the euro, the Japanese yen, the Canadian currency, flipping back and forth, you know, hundreds of billions, in fact, trillions of dollars a day. I mean, in some cases, you might have the same person buying and selling dollars, you know, at, you know, every half hour. You know, they're looking for very short-term movements. And what happened in the late 90s was the dollar, for a variety of reasons, came to be a very attractive currency. To some extent, that was government policy. You might recall that Robert Rubin said he favored a strong dollar, so he did what he could to, you know, say he wanted a good dollar, a strong dollar, I should say. And that certainly gave people encouragement to hold dollars. But the main reason people were buying up dollars from abroad in the late 90s was to get into our stock bubble. So the two kind of ran side by side. So what was happening then was people were buying up dollars to buy into the stock market in the United States, and that helped promote the stock bubble. It also raised the value of the dollar. I should also point out the flip side of that. It led to a very large trade deficit, because when we get a high dollar, suddenly, you know, if we're looking at buying goods from Korea or China, whatever country it might be, those goods are very cheap to us. You know, we could buy a lot of their currency for every dollar, so that means anything produced in Korea and China, clothes, toys, whatever it might be, cars, those become very cheap to us. So we got a very high dollar in the 90s, primarily because people are buying into our stock market. What happened in this decade, of course, the bubble burst, you know, 2000, 2001, 2002, and I should point out a lot of the people, foreigners investing, took very big hits on it, because they you know, you had companies like Daimler-Benz bought up Chrysler for, you know, I think it was $40 billion, and they ended up selling it for, you know, somewhere in the order of seven, you know, 5-6 years later. So they didn't do very well by that. But in any case, you know, they were putting money into our stock market, driving up the dollar in the end of the 90s. After the crash, you had people buying up dollars in large part just to keep their currencies down. And, you know, the big actor here, of course, is China. They're not the only one doing it. But China had a conscious policy of trying to keep its currency low against the dollar in order to sustain their export markets to the United States. So they've been buying up hundreds of billions of dollars, primarily just, you know, treasury bonds, short-term deposits, in order to keep the dollar high. That's a conscious policy. And what that does is keep their exports to the United States cheap. So we're buying lots of their clothes, lots of their toys, you know, all the goods that we're buying from China. And again, I shouldn't single out China here, because other countries are doing it as well. But, you know, that really is conscious policy. So in the short term, what that means is that we get these goods very cheaply, but that also means that we have a very large trade deficit that we all know about, and that's not going to be sustainable indefinitely, because at some point, you know, China and the other countries get tired of, you know, holding our dollars. They're not really getting any return on that.
Well, the Chinese actually started selling bonds last year, didn't they?
Well, they're certainly buying them at a lower rate. I don't think there's been any real sell-off, but, you know, they have a trade surplus on the order of $200 billion a year, and they're not buying bonds at the same rate as they had been. They're not selling off the ones. I mean, on certain days they may well be selling them, but they're not, you know, systematically dumping their dollar holdings. But in any case, they have allowed their currency to rise somewhat against the dollar. My expectation is that they'll allow it to rise more. They have good reasons for doing that. But the effect of that is that all the goods we're buying from China will start to cost us more. And as I said, we're already seeing that, so that over the last 3 months, the prices of goods that we import from China have risen at more than a 4% annual rate. I mean, that's not disastrous, but, you know, until very recently, they hadn't been rising at all.
Bad news for Walmart. I don't want to belabor this point, and I want to move on. And we've got some callers who are waiting to talk to us as well. But I just want to make sure I understand what we're talking about here. So what you're saying is that the value of currencies is controlled to a certain extent by speculation, but that government policy also can determine the value of its own currency. Would that be a fair summary?
Absolutely. You know, so in the U.S., it's been relatively informal that, you know, we had the Treasury Secretary, Robert Rubin, say he wanted a strong dollar, and that gave people encouragement because, you know, otherwise they could say, wait a second, the United States has a real big trade deficit, and usually you would think that a big trade deficit means that the currency is going to fall. But if you think that, you know, the government's behind the idea of having a strong dollar, then maybe you'd think, no, you know, that's okay, the dollar's going to stay strong so we could hold dollars. In the case of China, it's more deliberate. It's quite explicit. They're maintaining, You know, people talk about them manipulating their currency. I always get kind of angry at that because they're not manipulating it. They're quite, they have a policy. They tell you, you know, we're keeping down the value of our currency. So it's not, you know, I mean, you can call it manipulation if you like, but it's a stated policy. They're not doing anything secret. They're quite out there. We're keeping down the value of our currency. That's an explicit policy.
I seem to recall the United States government on a number of occasions taking the Chinese to task for not allowing the value of their currency to float against the rest of the world's currencies like other countries do. So that's what you're talking about. They're controlling the value of their currency to a great extent by government policy.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. All right. Well, now I've had my turn, and I'll shut up for a little bit. We'll just take some calls because we've got people stacked up here, and we want to get to them. So let's go first to June in Shawano. June, thanks for being patient. You're on the air.
Good morning. Before I ask my question, I'd like to presage it with this. I am an economist, and during the I was working at the producer price index during the stagflation period, and there was much that was similar about this period. However, we are now in the global economy, and we have drifted from, at that time, industrial output in the United States, we were still making steel here at that point, to the service economy. And my question is basically about regulation and deregulation of the financial markets, which seems to have a great deal to do with the current problem in the selling of these instruments. For example, the problem with overseas banks and financial institutions buying these instruments that are, you know, mortgages, in addition to others.
Yeah. Well, a couple points. First off, your point about the change in the economy is very well taken. I was just looking at the statistics on this. If you go back to the 70s, we had, you know, on the order of 30% of our workforce was in manufacturing, and, you know, there was a part of this was it was in the revision, so people didn't actually catch the month. But last October, we crossed 10%. So now less than 10% of our workforce is in manufacturing. So it's really just remarkable the rate at which we've lost manufacturing in the United States over the last, you know, two or three decades. So you're right, it's a very, very different economy today than it was in the 70s. Now, your point about deregulation, we deregulated a lot of sectors of the economy, and certainly in finance. We had the Glass-Steagall Act that was passed, I think it was 96, but in any case, in the mid-90s, that removed a lot of the regulations that had been in place from the Depression era. And that allowed for a lot of the nuttiness that we saw in the last few years that helped sustain the housing market. And, you know, sort of the central part of this story is that you had the separation between the people who issued mortgages and the investors that were holding the mortgage. You know, again, going back to, you know, 20, 30 years, the standard story was that you went to a local bank or savings and loan, you took out a mortgage, and typically they would hold that mortgage until you either sold your house or you paid it off. So they wanted to make very sure, perhaps too sure, that, you know, you were a person who could pay your mortgage. Today, or last few years, it's come to be absolutely standard that the people who issue the mortgage, they sell it as soon as they can into the secondary market where it's repackaged into securities that are issued against those mortgages, and those are sold all over the world. And what that means is that the people who issue the mortgage really don't care that the person they're issuing the mortgage to can sell it, can pay it off, because they're looking to sell it almost immediately. They only care they can make the sale. And this was an incredible failure of regulation. And again, this isn't hindsight, because I and, you know, many others were yelling about this 3, 4, 5, 6 years ago, saying, you know, you're having a lot of bad mortgages being made. These are not going to be paid off. They're going to go bad. People are going to get hurt. People are going to lose their homes. Investors are going to lose their shirts. This is all entirely predictable. But those who were in charge of the regulatory agencies, first and foremost, I'd say Alan Greenspan at the Fed, but, you know, there are many, many other people to blame here. They were just totally asleep at the wheel. They just were ignoring all the evidence that, you know, bad mortgages were being issued in abundance, and, you know, they let this go on. So it was a huge, huge regulatory failure.
Thanks for the call, June. Let's go next to Tom in Burlington.
Yes, and further to that point is, I'm a real estate broker, And when you buy a house, you're supposed to get an appraiser to come and make an independent appraisal of the property. And he takes that appraisal to the bank, and then the bank gives you a mortgage based upon what the independent appraiser gave you on that property. What happened was when if an appraiser in an area is not giving the inflated prices for the homes, the real estate people in that area do not use that appraiser. They go to someone who will give them the inflated appraisal. It's supposed to be a comparative market analysis. Yeah. And then what happens is you had this incredible inflation on these homes, and then they say, well, that home doesn't compare out. And they say, well, by the time you get to the bank in 30 days, the prices will have reached that mark. So there was no accountability there. There was no incentive for giving the correct numbers, because the banks could slough off this mortgage on somebody else, so they weren't at any kind of risk. And that was one of the problems. But now the problem is this. When we had a 1,300,000 homes being put on the market, being dumped on the real estate market, that causes the value of all the other homes to fall down. We have lost maybe $1 trillion in home equity properties. And the next question is this. Should if President Boyle or someone like that come along and say, here, I'm going to put a freeze on all foreclosures right now so we can stop this tremendous glut on the market here and do it in an orderly fashion so that we're not destroying things. And then the next question is, what kind of do we need a global currency in our market area here like they're having in the Eurozone, because now the Eurozone is becoming a competitor with our dollar?
Well, very good questions. First off, again, your point about appraisers is exactly right. And again, this is one of the things that was painful, because I was, getting stories. You knew this as a realtor. Other people knew this. Why didn't Alan Greenspan at the Fed know this? I mean, it was not a secret. This is going on all over the country, and the dynamics exactly as you described it, that, appraisers are typically independent contractors, and they're not stupid people. So they get called in, and if they come in with a low appraisal, they don't get called back. So, what's their incentive? They know that the bank wants to make the loan. So, whatever the house is worth, they up it by 10% or whatever, because they want to give a high number, because that's how you stay in business. So this is no secret. Everyone who wanted to knew it. Why Alan Greenspan and the other regulators didn't know it, I can't imagine. The point about foreclosures, absolutely. Foreclosures, the current rate is close to 2 million. In fact, the fourth quarter rate was just under 500,000. So, we're looking at putting on close to 2 million homes on the market. I guess not all foreclosures end up going on the market, but, well over a million, maybe as many as 1.5 million homes are coming on the market right now because they've been in foreclosure. That depresses home prices, even if you have builders cutting back, which they have been in a real huge way, and even if a lot of homeowners say, they're going to put off selling, you still have a huge number of homes come on the market because of foreclosure. So the question is, can we do something about that? I don't know if a foreclosure freeze is very practical. I know some people have been proposing that. I know Senator Clinton's proposed that in the context of her campaign. Problems with it, one, there's some legal issues. I know the federal government can do that. There's precedent from the Depression. The courts upheld that. But it would create certainly some legal complications. I'll just say that. It can be done, but it would create some complications. More importantly is what I worry about is obviously that would have to be legislation going through Congress. And, if you had just, a week, 2 weeks, however long, they're not going to do it a snap of a finger. You'd see an incredible rush of foreclosures as, all the lenders were worried that they would lose that option. So it might actually be self-defeating from that vantage point. So I'm not sure that would get you very far. A proposal that I've, put forward and have gotten some other economists to say that was a pretty good idea was to give people who are facing a foreclosure the option to stay in their home as renters. I call it own to rent and play with words there a little bit, that, if you're facing foreclosure, you tell the judge, look, I want to stay in the house as a renter, and, it might be you'd make it indefinite, but say 10 years, put some time limit on it, but in any case, have it be a significant period of time. So what that does is protect the homeowners that, they're not going to be thrown out on the street, that if, they like the home, they like the neighbor, they like the schools, they could at least stay there as a renter. But more importantly, we know that the banks don't want to become landlords. So if you told the banks that, the people that you're trying to foreclose on have the option to stay there as renters, it gives them a really strong incentive to go to the homeowners and renegotiate terms of the mortgage so that they could stay in the home as homeowners. And my bet is that if we change the rules that way, in the vast majority of cases, the people who are facing foreclosure would end up working out agreements and staying in their home as homeowners. So, you know, that's the sort of measure, you know, a lot of other people have put different things on the table, but, you know, to my mind, that's the sort of thing we should be looking to do, a fairly limited step that could at least protect the most vulnerable people. Now, the last point about a world currency, I think we need to do something better in terms of managing the dollar. We should never have let it get as overvalued as we did in the 90s, and it stayed overvalued through most of this decade. That was a very big mistake. Perhaps a world currency is an answer. There might be simpler things. So, you know, we could do intermediate steps. You know, you did have in Europe, before they actually formed the euro, they did have a system of managed exchange rates among the countries. So they kept their currencies, the dollar, the German mark against the French franc, against the English pound. They kept them within a relatively narrow band through government intervention. And something like that would probably be a good idea to prevent the sort of extreme movements in currency that we've seen over the last decade. So I think we could do intermediate things. I'm not necessarily opposed to a world currency. I just say it'd be very, very hard if you talk about having the politicians sit down and, you know, hammer out the obstacles to that. So I think it might be better just to take smaller steps first.
Let's take a call next from Jeremy in Wrightston.
Thanks for
Jeremy, you're
call.
On the air. Go ahead.
One of your callers before prefaced her call with the fact that she's an economist. I'll preface mine with the fact that I'm not. Something you said, though, much earlier in the program, before the half hour, struck me as interesting. You drew a parallel between the economy in the 70s with the rise in fuel prices and commodities with our current economy. And I noticed there was one thing that you didn't say, and I wanted to know your opinion on this, is that, you know, with the advent of biofuels, you mentioned the wheat prices in the 70s. How much impact does the advent of biofuels and tying the kind of the fuel and food commodities prices together have an impact on our economy, either positively or negatively, these days? And I'll take my answer off the air.
That's a really good question. We're seeing a rise in wheat prices, or I should say agricultural prices generally, for two reasons. One is certainly the rapid growth of China and India, which are importers of agricultural products. So we would probably see a strengthening of those markets in any case. But on top of that, you know, as we know, there's been this big rush to biofuels, to ethanol, you know, clearly, you know, promoted with subsidies, heavily subsidies from the government that's contributed to that. So I couldn't give you a good breakdown of, you know, how much is due to one rather than the other. I mean, that would require more careful analysis, and certainly I've done. But, you know, one of the big sources of inflation right now is in agricultural products, and clearly the switch to biofuels is contributing to that. I should point out, too, I mean, I take global warming very seriously, so I don't mean to dismiss measures to reduce global warming, but according to some studies that I wish I could remember now who put this out, but it was certainly a credible source, and I'm sorry, just drawing a blank on who put it out, but biofuels actually may not help in reducing global warming, because when you do a full analysis of the energy used in both creating the biofuel, creating the ethanol, and also take account of the loss of, you know, forest area, of agricultural area to produce the biofuels, that it's likely to be pretty much net out as zero, and in some cases perhaps even negative. I know our own biofuels are less energy efficient than, say, biofuel coming from cellulose made from, you know, sugar plants in Brazil, for example. So, you know, it probably is not a really good policy from the standpoint of reducing global warming, and insofar as it raises the cost of our food and contributes to inflation, that doesn't sound really good either. So we might want to rethink the subsidies for biofuels that we've been promoting the last few years.
We're talking about stagflation, about the state of our economy in this country, with Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. You can join us by phone. There's a line that just opened up at 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, please call us at 227-2050. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk some more with Mr. Baker about these economic issues. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this week. Kathleen should be back on the air next Tuesday. Next hour, we're going to talk about a bill that was just passed in the Wisconsin State Senate concerning a do-not-call list for cell phones. So now you can protect your cell phone from telemarketers, or at least you will be, if assuming the law passes the Assembly and is signed by the governor. And we'll have John Erpenbach, a state senator from Middleton, who was the author of this bill and its chief proponent, and he'll be on the air with us to talk about that. That's coming up after 10 o'clock this morning. This hour, we're talking about the economy, specifically something called stagflation. And we've been discussing that this hour with Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., who joins us by phone. And you can, too, as soon as the line opens up again, which it should shortly, at 800-486-8655 or 227-2050 if you're calling us from Milwaukee. Speaking of Milwaukee, let's go there next and take Michael from Milwaukee. Michael, good morning. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you. I'm really enjoying listening to Mr. Baker talk on this subject. I mean, it's fascinating, and he's calling it like it is. And I enjoy him saying that, or I appreciate him saying, or whatever, that how everybody should have seen this coming, because, you know, most people out in the real world could see what was happening in the housing industry. It was just this big sham. You knew people that were buying homes that they couldn't afford. They were getting loans that they didn't qualify for, and there was no way that they were going to pay them back. And it's almost like the powers that be actually wanted this to happen. I think the economy has been sick for quite a few years, actually. It just wasn't showing up because of the dynamics of the housing industry, and because of these inflated house prices, people were withdrawing equity out of their houses, and it kept the economy going where, you know, the economy was a lot sicker than what most people believed. And, you know, you could see this coming for years. You know, you had a collapse of industry in this country. You lost jobs. You had deficit spending. You had a big trade deficit. And sooner or later, it was going to come to pass. I mean, everybody could foresee what was going to happen. I can't believe that anybody should actually act surprised because it did.
Well, I'm very much inclined to agree. I mean, you know, the story, you know, I see the with the Fed and the housing bubble, I don't know Alan Greenspan, so it's a little hard. I won't want to attribute motives to him. I don't know what exactly his thinking was. But, you know, in 2001, 2002, the economy was in a recession because of the stock market crash, and it was very slow coming out of that. And, you know, we continued to see the unemployment rate rise through 2002. People say the recession ended in 2001, and that's true. The folks that date recession say the recession ended in November 2001. But the fact is, the economy continued to shed jobs into 2002, and in fact, most of the way through 2003. So the economy was very, very weak. And, you know, you mentioned the trade deficit. The trade deficit kept growing through this period. The only only dynamic sector was the housing market. And, you know, Alan Greenspan surely must have seen that, you know, whether he was actually trying to promote it, consciously promote the housing bubble. He surely recognized that that was the, you know, leading sector in the economy. We saw a huge increase in housing starts and housing sales. You know, we have jobs created up and down the line there because, you know, you have your realtors, the mortgage brokers, you know, and of course, when people get a new home, they get, you know, appliances. They, you know, so there's all these jobs being created, you know, directly through the housing industry. But then on top of that, you know, as you'd mentioned, people are borrowing against their homes to buy cars, take vacations. So surely Greenspan knew this. Now, did he consciously try to promote the bubble? You know, I don't know. One thing I will say is that he actively discouraged anyone from thinking there was a bubble. In fact, I first began to look at this issue closely because I read testimony he gave before Congress back in 2002 where he said there was no bubble. And, you know, I was reading what he was saying, and it didn't make any sense. And that was how I first came on. You know, I looked at the data very closely and said, yes, there is a bubble. You know, but he was very determined to tell, you know, say people like me were wrong. You know, so whether he was doing this to promote a housing bubble or he just, you know, didn't want to look, somehow didn't see it, you know, I can't really answer that question. But at the very least, it's clear he did nothing to counteract it. And, you know, as it is, you know, we see that bubble eventually, you know, collapsed of its own weight, which is what bubbles will do.
Now, one thing here, I think that probably to have give a little context to this, hasn't there been a real shift over the last 30 years, both in business and in government, to focus entirely on the short term? Corporations now operate under the tyranny of the current quarter and are entirely focused on increasing shareholder value this afternoon rather than taking any sort of a long-term view for the future. I know a person who's happens to be a fairly high executive in a Fortune 500 company who complained to me about that. He said, you know, this is crazy. It can't be sustained. You've got to jump through all these hoops and do all these things you know are wrong in order to make the current quarter look good so that the stock price stays up. Isn't that kind of the culture that we're in now?
I think that's very much the case. There was a study done about a year or so ago, and it was looking at the pattern of earnings. And what they were doing was saying, how probable is it that you're going to get earnings growth quarter after quarter, and you know, for various periods of time, 16 quarters in a row, 20 quarters in a row? And ordinarily, you wouldn't expect that for the simple reason that, you know, there's variation. You know, sometimes not necessarily you did a bad job, but, you know, there's things you didn't expect. You know, for whatever reason, the economy slowed last quarter. There were a lot of your competitor had a big sale. They had a good month or whatever it was. So you wouldn't expect, you know, just looking randomly that it'd be common for companies to have, you know, 16 quarters of consecutive profit growth or 20 quarters of consecutive profit growth. But yet you find that again and again and again. And then when you look at more closely, you realize, well, executives have a lot of ability to manipulate their reported profits. So they could write down losses at, you know, at a certain time. They could delay writing down losses. They could take certain, you know, certain charges as credits to profit. So they have a lot of room to manipulate their reported profits, which doesn't do anything for the company at the end of the day, but it can make their stock price go up. And if the executive who's, you know, in control of this is saying, well, I've got options that come due this year, and then I'm out of here after that, well, that's what they care about. They want to make sure the stock price is good when they cash in their options. And if next year, you know, their successor has to pick up the pieces, that's not their problem.
Let's take a call from Julie in Rice Lake.
Thanks.
Julie, good morning.
Hello?
Yes, you're on.
Okay. I thank you for being on. I also am not an economist, but I appreciate your ability to explain things in easily understandable language. My question has to do with the dollar versus foreign currencies. And I wonder, was the dollar weak against foreign currencies during the 70s stagflation period as it is today, and why or why not? And related to that is I've noticed recently that the Canadian dollar is now worth pretty much exactly what the U.S. dollar is, and I have never seen that in my life, and I'm getting close to 50 years old here, and to me, that's headline news, and I'm just wondering, like, was the government intentionally soft-pedaling this or what? I mean, to me, that's kind of alarming, but maybe it shouldn't be, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, well, I'll take the second one first. Actually, if you go far enough back, I don't know if I'm much older than Julie, but if you go far enough back, the Canadian dollar and the U.S. dollar were actually pretty close back in the 60s and 70s. In fact, I remember as a kid, every now and then you'd get a Canadian quarter, and we'd just treat them like, you know, U.S. quarters, you know, but I don't know if that was entirely legal, but I mean, you can get a Canadian quarter and typically spend it just as if it were a U.S. quarter, and most people would take them. I don't recall anyone ever making an issue of it.
Vending machines had problems with them.
Vending machines wouldn't take them. No, we tried that.
Yeah.
But
right.
You know, so anyhow, they did used to be very close. If you go far enough back, they were very close in value. Then the dollar rose a lot against the Canadian currency, you know, in the last decade or so, and then it plummeted. And, you know, I think for a while, I should know the rate today, but for a while, the Canadian currency was actually worth a few more cents than the U.S. dollar. So it was like $1.03, $1.04, and, you know, I could probably check and find out easily enough what it is today. But, yeah. That is a huge switch. Now, it's not necessarily a big problem. Basically, the story was the dollar was overvalued. You had to see a reversal like that. I don't know, you know, exactly what the proper value of the Canadian dollar should be or where it will be 2 or 3 or 4 years from now. But, you know, we had to see something like the downward adjustment we actually did see. So, you know, that was inevitable. I don't think it's painful in the sense that all the things we get from Canada, or if you want to go, you know, go on a trip to Canada, will cost us more. But that really was inevitable, so I don't think that in and of itself is bad news. Now, your other question is, what about in the 70s? The dollar actually was falling in the 70s. We had a very large trade, or I shouldn't say very large, we had a trade deficit. We would never think of it as large today, but we began running a trade deficit in the 70s, primarily because of the big jump up in oil prices. And that put downward pressure on the dollar because, you know, through the 50s and 60s, the United States typically ran a trade surplus. And, you know, back then, economists used to think that a rich country like the United States should run a trade surplus. The idea was that we should be exporting more than we're importing. We'd be lending, in effect, money to the rest of the world, particularly the poor countries, to enable them to develop. And that, in principle, would be a win-win because, you know, we're producing more than we can consume here, at least that, so the thinking ran, and we'll lend that, you know, we'll give or sell, I should say, that additional production to poor countries who will then pay us back when they've, you know, become more, when they become wealthier and more developed. So that was how it was supposed to go. Now, the last 20, 25 years, almost every single year, and I'm saying almost because I can't say for certain, but I think it might have been every year, we've had a trade deficit. We flipped that over, and of course we had very, very large trade deficits, you know, 03, 04, 05, 06, where we were borrowing in a very big way from, you know, relatively poor countries like China, countries in Latin America. We were actually borrowing from them. They were lending us money. So, you know, we really flipped over the story from where we were in the 50s and 60s to where we are today. In the 70s, we thought that was bad news. More recently, you know, or at least our political leaders have tried to tell us that was really good news. I never really thought that, but that's what they were saying.
Let's talk next to Aaron in La Crosse. Aaron, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Just turned into wire there, I guess. My comment is, well, it's a twofold question, more like the comments that were made earlier about keeping the stock prices up. The kind of the term you stationed deflationary, isn't this the same kind of thing that's happening in the automobile market where, you know, the 2009s come out in 2008s and then at the, you know, end of the summer they have to get all the 2008s off the lot to make room for the 2009s and so forth and so on?
Well, in terms of house prices?
Yes, and just in the relationship of the two industries and the way, you know, they market and the pricing in itself.
Well,
because you made mention of, you know, that when people were buying houses in the 70s and the builders were trying to build more houses to forecast, you know, a profit or so forth.
Yeah, well, people obviously are moved by their expectations. So what was going on, you know, earlier in this decade was everyone was expecting house prices to continue to go up. So you get this, you know, Greenspan used the term about the stock bubble, irrational exuberance. You know, people just, you know, they're not sitting back and thinking clearly what is this, what are the underlying factors in this market. They're just going, well, house prices went up 15%, 20%. A lot of markets, that was true. You know, South Florida, Southern California, they were going up 15, 20% every year. So, you know, what they would do in terms of building a home, they're going, well, you know, I could sell this for 20% more next year than, you know, what prices are this year. So that looks like a real good deal. So builders were anxious to build as quickly as they could, particularly, you know, in condos. There's huge glut in condos in large parts of the country because you could build condos quickly. So that meant they built a lot of them. So, you know, so they built a huge number of condos. But on top of that, you know, that infected everyone's mentality. You know, we had the caller earlier, the realtor was talking about how, you know, the banks were saying, well, you know, if it's not worth that today, it'll be worth that much in, you know, 2 months or 3 months, so don't worry about it. And, you know, if people come to expect that prices will rise, that creates an environment in which prices actually do rise, you know, and, you know, until at some point, as I say, you just get too much supply and that overcomes the expectations.
We're just about out of time. I want to ask kind of a concluding question here, and if you could keep your answer to a minute, that would be great. Is there something that policymakers could do to solve the problem that we're in right now? Is there one magic bullet, or are we in for a long haul?
Well, you know, I'd mentioned that own-to-rent plan, giving people, homeowners who are losing their home, the option to rent. I think that's a good sort of remedial step that limits the damage. But the basic story is that house prices have to fall, and there's no pretty way you could do that. I mean, a caller earlier said we'd lost a trillion in housing wealth. I actually think it's, you know, probably closer to $2 trillion at this point. My estimate of the amount of bubble wealth we have in the economy is about $8 trillion, which is $110,000 for every homeowner in the country. That's not evenly distributed. You're going to see bigger losses in places like California, Las Vegas, and Florida than probably Wisconsin. But that is going to be a really, really hard hit. So we're going to see stagnation coming from the collapse of the housing bubble. We will see inflation from the fall in the dollar. I don't think there's a way to avoid that. The best thing we could do is try and get through this quickly and get the economy back on a stable footing again.
Dean Baker, thank you for joining us this hour. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., joined us by telephone. Next hour, it's Do Not Call for Cell Phones, so we'll get off the money question. This hour was produced by Carmen Jackson with on-air production by John Tretter and Bill Estes. If you'd like to call a radio store and order a copy of it, it's available. Call 800-747-7444 and ask for program 221D, as in dollar.
Money, it's a gas.